Science fiction has always been full of stories about people from Earth traveling to visit other planets and meeting wild and wonderful and often scary creatures from those planets. Science fact still has not caught up with the creatures, but we do know for sure that there are planets revolving around other stars, lots of them. Since they are outside our solar system, we call them exoplanets. That is also the name of a new book by a couple of well-traveled authors, Michael Summers and James Treffel. James Treffel is a professor of physics at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. He writes a lot of books in addition to this one, more than 50, and has won awards for his work, including the American Institute of Physics Writing Award. Jim, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
My pleasure.
So my memory casts back to elementary school and the school librarian, Mrs. Buden, asking me when I was asking her for books about other solar systems, whether there were other solar systems. So this is a fairly recent thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's basically, we have new technology now to look for planets around other stars. What the main method is called transit, that if a planet passes between the star and you, it absorbs some of the light from the star. So if you're looking at the star, you see it get a little bit dimmer for a while, and then when the planet passes, it gets brighter again. And in 2009, we launched a satellite. It's called a Kepler. And this is the incredible thing to me. It looks at 150,000 stars continuously looking for these dips. And as soon as it sees one, it passes the ball back to a telescope on the ground.
But 150,000 stars, the way that there are images in the book, which is great to look at exoplanets with artists' conceptions and some real pictures here, too, of what can be seen from here, which is not much. At Kepler, it's really kind of like shining a flashlight in a dark basement, isn't it? It's a fairly narrow beam.
We have explored such a small fraction of the galaxy. When I give these, I sometimes enjoy giving these talks to grade school kids. And I point out to them, I said, look, we've explored this little, like you said, the narrow beam of the galaxy, and the rest is up to you, pal.
So in those years when we thought we might have been one of a kind, that there was one solar system, did we make some assumptions about the universe?
Yeah, well, it's always, the assumption you always make is that everything else out there has to be like what you're used to. And one of the things we're learning from exoplanets and from the kinds of things we're finding out there is that it's just not true, that we are not typical. We're not atypical either. We're just one of, we've found 4,000 planets so far, and there are billions in the galaxy.
Well, so 4,000 planets, it makes a lot more than just the 9 we thought we had when we were kids. But, you know, we've learned a lot, as you point out in the book, from our outer planets and their moons. What kinds of things have we learned?
Well, the main thing we're learning is that there's a lot of water in the universe. You know, life on Earth developed in water, and so we always think if we're going to find life like us, it's going to be in some kind of ocean or, you know, a watery environment. And we're finding out that, let me back up a little. We used to think that if you got to the outer solar system, they were all cold and dead, and there could not be any water out there, and therefore no life. What we're finding is that a lot of the moons of Jupiter have subsurface oceans, which actually have more water than the Earth's oceans. And so there's plenty of water out there, plenty of chance for life, even in our own solar system. And, of course, that just multiplies.
So Pluto gets some sympathy here. What did you guys make of its demotion from one of the 9 planets to a dwarf planet that didn't count?
On my honest opinion?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it's one of the silliest things ever that any scientific organization has. Put it right up there with demoting the Brontosaurus.
Okay. We'll pick it up on the other side of a break. James Treffel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Michael Summers of the book Exoplanets, Diamond Worlds, Super Earths, Pulsar Planets, and the New Search for Life Beyond Our Solar System. We'll pick up the conversation on the other side of the break. You can join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. We are continuing a conversation with Dr. James Treffel. He is a physicist at George Mason University in Northern Virginia, the co-author with Michael Summers of a book called Exoplanets, about all those planets outside of our solar system that we once theorized about and for about 25 years now have known about with conclusive evidence. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jim, we were just talking about Pluto and its demotion to dwarf planet, but even on beyond Pluto, there are other things that are still captive to our sun's gravity. Are there other big rocks out there that might be considered planets or might have been at one time?
Oh, for sure. We found lots of planets. It's a region called the Kuiper Belt. If you think of the solar system as being kind of like an old vinyl record, all the planets are in that same record. And you go out farther, you find a lot of loose rocks, but many, many planets, including recently people have suggested there's one out there that's about 10 times larger than the Earth, which it makes it kind of hard to call it a dwarf, you know.
Truly, yeah. In fact, I noticed that there's a move afoot to get Pluto reconsidered a planet and a bunch of others as well. I mean, could we go potentially from the current 8 to a much larger number?
I don't see why not. Chemists went through this in the 19th century when they discovered all the new chemical elements. And they started out thinking there were only a few chemical elements, and now they're 118. Well, if that's what nature gives you, that's what you got to deal with. And there's nothing wrong with having a large number of planets.
You mentioned that the Kepler spacecraft put up in 2009 really helped the search for exoplanets. Before Kepler, how hard was it to find other planets with the tools we had available?
Yeah, well, see, the problem is that the planets don't have their own light. They shine by reflected light. So it's not that they're dim, but they're right next to a star. The way one guy put it, he says, look, it's like having a birthday candle next to a searchlight in Boston and trying to see the birthday candle from it with a telescope in Washington, D.C., you know.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, and so you can't see the planets directly. What people used to do is they would look for motion of the star. Like when Jupiter goes around the sun, it pulls the sun toward it, and so the sun makes a little loop. It's kind of like you ever had a washing machine on spin cycle and it gets off balance?
Oh, yeah, you got a rug in there or something. Wub, wub, wub.
Yeah, it's something like that. So the sun does that kind of thing, and you can detect that. And the first exoplanets that were found, in fact, were found with that technique. But that's a long process, and you had maybe a dozen exoplanets by the time Kepler was launched.
So how many? I'm curious to know in the process of deciding, okay, that little transit there where the light dimmed for a moment. I mean, how many times that has to happen before somebody says, okay, for sure that's a planet that's making that light dim?
Well, that's a very good question. The thing, this is why I mentioned earlier that once the Kepler has spotted one of these things, it's passed off to a telescope on Earth, because the Kepler time is much too valuable to do that kind of analysis. But if you look at some of these exoplanets, their year is like 6 Earth days long or 10 Earth days long. So you see those dips, repeatedly. But if you were looking at our solar system, it takes Jupiter 10 years to go around. You'd have to watch for 10 years to see the whole cycle.
So if we can only tell that they're there, I mean, how can we make some assumptions about what they're made of and what their surfaces are like and that sort of thing?
Well, that gets a little tricky. By looking at how much light is absorbed, you can tell how big it is, what the radius of the planet is. And by looking at its orbit, and particularly if there are several planets in the system, you can tell the mass. So that tells you the average density of the planet. And so that tells you, are you dealing with a gas giant? Are you dealing with something that's small and rocky? And you can make those kind of conclusions. But, as to say, well, it's got this much ytterbium and that much iridium and that much carbon, no, we can't do that.
So how do the findings among those 4,000 or so exoplanets compare with the offerings in our own system? Is it pretty much the kinds of things we have, the gas giants, the little icy, rocky ones, and a couple of planets that look like they might be able to support life?
Well, the thing is that there's a lot more out there than exists in our own solar system. Just to give you one example, most of the other systems we see, or many of the other systems we see, have what are called super-Earths. They're rocky planets that are maybe between 10 times and 20 times the size of the Earth. There's something between the Earth and Neptune in size. But we don't have that in our system. We just don't. We don't know about how many planets in other systems are in very far away from their star. We don't know how many of them are in places where they could have liquid water on their surface. There's a lot of things like this where our system seems to be atypical.
Our system is atypical?
There aren't other systems out there like us.
Hmm.
But that doesn't say much, because if you pick any other system out there, there's not any systems around there that are like it either.
Okay. So each system has its own unique setup.
Yeah, there's a huge variety of stuff out there.
Jim Treffel's our guest on The Exchange. He and Michael Summers are the authors of the book Exoplanets, Diamond Worlds, Super Earths, Pulsar Planets, and the New Search for Life Beyond Our Solar System. Join the conversation as we talk about turning what we learned on Star Trek into reality. There actually are all those planets out there. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. Questions and comments by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When we start thinking about the potential for life on some of these exoplanets, Jim, I mean, are we defining life by our own terms?
Well, in fact, my co-author Mike Summers and I are thinking about this very seriously, about doing another book just about the possibility of life. Because you start out with what you're familiar with. So we say all life on Earth is basically the result of one experiment. And so we have carbon molecules in water, and that's how you get to life. Now, that's the first thing we're going to look for out there, because we'll know it when we see it. But, you know, there are other definitions. You could have silicon instead of carbon, for example. You could have life that isn't chemical at all. We wouldn't recognize it. And if you had life, silicon life, and it was looked like a mineral, and it took 1,000 years to take a breath, would we recognize it as living, or would we just say, well, that's just a rock, you know? And so the problem of how you go about defining life and looking for it is not an easy one.
Okay, but, you know, we tend to think in terms of carbon-based, all that sort of thing. I mean, so as you point out, in fact, there's a whole discussion of the Chauvin, the French man who gave us the term chauvinism. So we tend to think in terms of it's got to be like us for it to be life.
Yeah, we call that carbon chauvinism, but the point is, you're going out to look for something. You don't know what you're going to find. The first thing you're going to look for is stuff that's familiar to you. That's just human nature.
So let's go really big. I mean, what do we know from the exoplanets? How have they improved our knowledge of how planets form in the first place?
Well, the formation of the planets is the solar system formed by the condensation of material from a dust cloud in the sky. We see this process going on in other places in the galaxy. That's in pretty good shape. We know that the early years of our solar system were very chaotic, in that we kicked a lot of planets out of the solar system early on just by gravitational interactions. And what that means is there are a lot of planets out there that aren't circling stars. In fact, there are probably more planets that aren't circling stars than there are planets circling stars.
Rogue planets? They're just out wandering around?
Yeah. We call them rogue planets, and they're almost impossible to detect, but we know they're out there, and we've seen a few of them. And that sort of really, if you want to stretch your imagination, imagine a world like that. The way I talk about it, I say, hey, look, you know, you still have all these sources of heat inside the planet, radioactivity and stuff like that. And it's like a house where you've turned off the lights, but you've got the furnace going. And so there could be life on those planets, too.
Wow. And so, I mean, are they captive? I mean, are they just sort of moving on gravitational tides out there? They just sort of move
to
and through?
With the galaxy. You know, it depends on how they got kicked out, but they have an orbit around the center of the galaxy just like the sun does.
So based on the formation of solar systems and these rogue planets getting kicked out, I mean, is it fairly predictable then you're going to get your rocky, your icy, your gas giant, that sort of thing?
We see all of those things. We see other things that aren't like them. We see, I call it styrofoam world, a planet that has density is much less than water. It would float. If you could have an ocean big enough, it would float, you know, and we have no idea what it is, why it doesn't collapse under its own gravity. There are planets that are made of almost pure carbon. They're close into their stars. They have volcanoes that spew out diamonds. You know, they're just a huge variety of things that are there. It blows your mind when you start thinking about it.
Do the different forms of these planets perhaps represent phases? I mean, was Earth once a larger gaseous planet before it condensed?
No. The inner planets, that is Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and Mars, formed close to the sun inside of what's called the frost line. And inside, things like water were vaporized, and then the solar wind blew them out. So all you had left to build the planets are small rocky things, sand grains, think mineral grains. And so they formed that way. The outer planets, formed by a different process, probably have a small core that looks like the Earth, but then they collected all these hydrogen and stuff which was out there, and it was too far out to be vapor form. And so it stayed there, and that became the outer planets.
So do we have whole new categories of planets then that we've discovered through the discoveries of the exoplanets?
Yeah, I'm sure we do. The super-Earth is one that I mentioned earlier, and there are probably many more. People are still in the process of trying to get this all organized. And if you want a nice taxonomy of planets, I don't think we have that yet, but it will come.
Jim Treffel's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He and Michael Summers, the co-authors of Exoplanets, Diamond Worlds, Super Earths, Pulsar Planets, and the New Search for Life Beyond Our Solar System. 4,000 exoplanets we know about now. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So some of these unique categories are diamond planets. I mean, like diamonds that we know on Earth?
Yeah, look, a diamond is just carbon, right? It's a form of carbon. It's like the graphite in your pencil. It just had been subjected to very high pressure and temperatures. And these diamond planets have a lot of carbon in them. They tend to be very close to their stars. In fact, one of them that we know is actually inside the star, if you can imagine that. And so they're just different from the Earth.
The diamond planet, wait, there's one inside a star, you're saying?
Inside the atmosphere of the stars.
Okay.
Not all the way inside, but yeah, inside the star's atmosphere.
Wow, okay, and there are certainly ice worlds. I mean, are there worlds that are nothing but water ice?
There are probably lots of worlds like Pluto, but we know that Pluto has a subsurface ocean. We don't know how it stays warm, but we do know it's there. I assume there are going to be a lot of planets like that. The ice worlds would be very common.
So how do we know that there are subsurface oceans, and how far below the surface might they be kept?
Basically, you know that let me talk about the one we know best, which is on a moon called Europa, which is one of the moons of the planet Jupiter. Because we had a spaceship called the Galileo that was spent many years in the vicinity of Jupiter making measurements. And you measure the gravitational fields, you measure the magnetic fields, and from that you can deduce what's inside, what's under the ice on the surface. And it turns out to be water.
How thick the ice?
That's a good question, because one of the things that NASA is trying to do is to design a mission to go to this place and drill through the ice. And it could be as much as 100 miles. It could be as much as 100 yards in spots. We just don't know.
Huh. Okay. And what happened to the Galileo spacecraft?
Well, once we found that there was a possibility of life on Europa, we didn't want there to be any possibility of contaminating the moon with Earth, you know, materials or Earth bacteria. And so the Galileo was actually sent into Jupiter, and it was destroyed.
A crash landing, just to make sure that it didn't potentially contaminate Europa?
That's right.
Wow, that's very sensitive for Earthlings. But I often wondered about whether there were concerns about us carrying microbes on these vessels, even on deep space probes. Is there a chance that microbes could live through years of traveling through cold interplanetary space?
Well, it doesn't seem likely, but my biologist friends tell me that it's not impossible. So, it's something you worry about. And in this particular case, where you want to keep Europa pristine for when we actually get there and to start exploring, then getting rid of the Galileo is kind of a no-brainer.
Uh-huh. But that's interesting. So think about the kind of level of sterility they'd have to go through to be able to get a probe to go to some place and look for life and make sure it didn't bring the life with it.
Well, there's a whole office in NASA that's just concerned with that problem. And it's two problems. One is carrying stuff out there, and the other is bringing stuff back, like if we do a Mars return mission. And I know, and as far as the outward bound thing is, they typically will bake a satellite for many days at very high temperature to kill everything that's on it.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff to go through. Tell us about some recent discoveries and some of the excitement about them. Kepler-186f, what is that?
Kepler-186f, the F means it's the A, B, C, D, E, F. It's the fourth planet that was found around this particular star. A is for the star, and then you start going alphabetically.
Okay.
And it's a planet a little bigger than the Earth. And it's in what's called the continuously habitable zone. What that means is it's close, like the Earth, it's close enough to the star that liquid water can stay on the surface for long periods of time. It's the first planet we found like that. It's called the Goldilocks planet because it's not too hot and it's not too cold. It's just right. You know, that's the way that name comes from. And so this is the kind of place where we look for, or we want to examine for evidence of life like us.
So it's a CHZ, continuously habitable zone. So in other words, it's a regular enough temperature that the water stays free. So not necessarily just like the Earth, but we think perhaps within the range.
Yeah, I mean it has an environment. It has liquid water on its surface, or it can have liquid water on its surface. over long periods of time, which means that life could develop there as it developed here.
All right, so then, as you point out in the book, I mean, we believe that there are ice worlds out there. Are there worlds that are all water as well?
Sure. I mean, basically, this is the way I like to say it. If you can imagine a world, I'm willing to bet that there's one of them out there. The craziest thing you can think of, and there'll be at least one, because there's so many planets that the probability of finding almost anything is just astronomical.
So it really is like so the variations are great. But so not just the planets themselves that differ, the exoplanets themselves, but the stars that they move around. I mean, there are some things that I think physicists like yourself thought were impossible. I mean, what kinds of star systems are home to planets?
Well, I'll tell you, the first one that was found, which is back in the 90s, was around a type of star called a pulsar. A pulsar is the remains of a star that went supernova and exploded, you know. And so somehow these planets either survived the explosion, which I for the life of me, I can't figure out how that could happen, or they formed after the explosion, which isn't supposed to happen either. So the first planets we found out there were exactly the kind that we never expected to see, but there they are.
How long, and in the case of, for example, Kepler-186f, so I assume that the Kepler spacecraft detected it in sometime after 2009 then, what other processes then are done by scientists to confirm the finding, to corroborate the data, to figure out if, in fact, it is the kind of world that the first hypothesis came up with?
Yeah, there's a long process by which, you see this dip in the luminosity, the dip in brightness that we talked about. And then you got to say, well, is it really a planet? Is it maybe a double star system? Are you, given that you got a telescope that has a finite resolution, could it be you're looking at something, a star here and then another star much farther away, but they look like they coincide with each other? There are a lot of things that have to be ruled out, and the object goes through a series of things. It becomes first it becomes an object of interest, then it becomes a candidate, and then finally it becomes a planet.
James Treffel's our guest on The Exchange, the co-author with Michael Summers of a book on exoplanets, planets outside of our own solar system, 4,000 by latest count. You know, I was asking about whether planets could indicate that there are different phases. If, you know, for example, a gas giant could become a small rocky planet like Earth, and you said probably not. But there are changes in the planets we know and are able to see a fair amount. I mean, did Mars, for example, at one point, have liquid water on time?
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that planets can't change. The change you were suggesting is pretty big.
Yeah, I understand that. Too big a change. But so Mars might have actually had some water on it.
Oh, it did. It still does. I mean, we can see shorelines, and the whole northern part of the planet was once covered with an ocean. This is why people are so curious about being able to get there and bring something back, because when life developed on Earth, Mars still had oceans, so life could have been developing there. And that would be another experiment in life, and if we could find evidence for it.
So what happened to the oceans on Mars?
Basically, Mars is very small, so it doesn't have a very strong gravitational pull. And basically, the water molecules just drifted off into space eventually.
Yikes. So that you're saying Earth is big enough, so that probably wouldn't happen?
No, Earth is bigger enough, has a stronger gravity. Now, the polar caps on Mars are both liquid water and what we call dry ice, liquid carbon dioxide. So there is water there left. It's just not liquid.
When you get into the section of the book where you're talking about conjecture about life on other worlds, there is apparently a conversation in science about RNA world versus metabolism first. What's that about?
This is a question. See, we understand some things about how life developed on Earth, and there's one gap in that understanding. We understand how you can get big organic molecules. They apparently are very easy to make. We find them all over the place. We find them in meteorites. We find them in interstellar dust clouds. And so getting the basic building blocks for a living system is not hard. The question we're wrestling with is, how do you go from those basic building blocks to the first cell that divides and starts proliferating? And the two things you talk about, RNA is a molecule that in our cells carries out some of the functions in making our chemistry work. The thought is that this is a molecule that developed first. This is the RNA world. And we find out that it can act both as a catalyst for chemical reactions and as something for information carrying. The metabolism first is an alternate scenario for that particular process of taking the molecules that you made and turning them into a living system. That begins with the analogy I like to use is like looking at the interstate highway system. You know, you begin pre-Columbian with game trails, and then you had wagon roads, and then you had paved roads, and then you had the interstate system. The interstate system didn't just appear all at once. And the metabolism first tries to trace the chemistry of how that happened with living systems, how you went from something very simple to something fairly complex.
There's a question you pose in the book that I've often wondered about, which is, are we sure we'd know life if we saw it? Are we fairly confident we would?
I don't think so.
Really?
If it's based on carbon molecules, we'd probably recognize it. If it's something different, I'm not sure. What if it's just electric?
So I imagine we're fairly excited to find out that there are 4,000 exoplanets just that we know about and probably many, 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 many more out there.
Billions more.
Jim Treffel is the co-author with Michael Summers of Exoplanets. Jim is a professor of physics at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.